This is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. I've spent the last year and a half interviewing political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders about their story and their place on the great battlefield. This is the 11th in a series of episodes since the midterm where I catch up with previous guests. In this one, I spoke with two now prominent people who built organizations post-Trump that were used by millions of people. One started as a Facebook group and the other as a targeting tool for volunteer efforts in congressional campaigns. They are Sean Eldridge at Stand Up America and Ethan Todras Whitehill with Swing Left. For more background on Sean, listen to my full-length interview with him in episode 7. For more background on Ethan, listen to my full interview with him in episode 22. Now, my catch-up interview with Sean at Stand Up America.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from Timeplots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. Timeplots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Sean, it's been, I think it's been since May or June of 2017 since we talked.
Yeah, it's been quite a while. A lot has happened.
What has happened? When we talked last, I guess, I don't know, you're up to about a million members and you were, you know, small nonprofit posting a lot of interesting stuff about resisting Trump. What's happened since?
Yeah, so obviously a lot has happened in our country, but a lot has happened with Stand Up America as well. Our community has grown quite a bit since we last talked a year and a half ago. We're over 2 million progressives across the country now. The growth has just continued. The resistance continues to get stronger and stronger. And we've been part of a lot of really important fights and, you know, everything from the midterm elections last year, which were obviously historic. But also we've been really consistently involved in a number of big advocacy issues, particularly the Trump-Russia investigation. We've really focused and been one of the loudest grassroots communities demanding the truth and making it clear that Donald Trump is not above the law in that investigation. And, you know, we are very excited to kick off 2019 with a new progressive Congress that's going to provide a lot of opportunities to hold Trump accountable and hopefully move some progressive policies forward.
It would be good to see some of that happening. It still seems like kind of a mess right now, though, with a shutdown and still control of the Senate on the other side and still Trump in the presidency.
Yeah, it is a mess. There's no question about it. But I think despite the mess that Donald Trump is bringing to our country and our democracy every day, I think having progressives at the helm in the House is going to make a difference. And we're already seeing it, right? Trump is throwing a tantrum every day, demanding his racist, dumb wall. And Democrats in the House and the Senate are saying no. And they're blocking that part of his agenda. And yeah, I mean, the shutdown is just, you know, one of many examples of how Donald Trump is wreaking havoc. There are hundreds of thousands of government employees who have kids, who have spouses, who have rents to pay, bills to pay, groceries to buy. And their livelihood is being held hostage so that Donald Trump can make a political point. So that is ridiculous. And I'm really glad to see progressives standing firm. That said, despite this historically long shutdown already, I'm actually optimistic about 2019. I think we saw House Democrats come in and really kick off with the right priorities. As you may know, H.R. 1, the first House resolution put forward, was a bold package to tackle corruption and strengthen our democracy. And I think that says a lot, that progressives are listening to the fact that Americans feel like the system is broken, the system is rigged, and they're kicking off the year and kicking off this new Congress by expanding voting rights, by tackling campaign finance reform. So that gives me hope despite the shutdown. And, you know, we've realized at Stand Up America that even though we're a large resistance community, even though we have a growing team of awesome organizers in New York City that allows us to do more and more, we can't do everything. So in 2019, we're really focusing on three fights that come with this new Congress. One is standing up to corruption and standing up to Donald Trump's corruption. The second is really making sure we continue to protect the Trump-Russia investigation. Our community has now made over 150,000 phone calls to Congress demanding the Mueller protection bill be passed. And then finally, we're focused on strengthening democracy. And that comes with resolutions like HR1. And for the first time, we're actually getting involved in state work, which we've never done before. So here in New York State, we are part of the coalitions that are fighting for expanded voting rights and robust campaign finance reform in New York. So yeah, I mean, many parts of our country remain in chaos because of Donald Trump. A lot of people continue to get hurt. But I think there still is room to move the ball forward despite that.
I'm curious what you're learning about running a group like this. What sort of tools are working best to, to grow your community and to throw the weight around in the most effective way?
Yeah, I'm learning a lot every single day. I mean, first of all, to state the obvious, having a great team makes a huge difference. When I last talked to you, Stand Up America was really a large Facebook community and a very small team. And we've managed to grow our team out to a lot of talented organizers who are bringing experience.
How many people now?
We're about a dozen and growing more this year. So keep an eye out for some job descriptions that are coming. But yeah, in terms of tools, we've been experimenting quite a bit. We actually early in 2018 partnered with Higher Ground Labs, who I know you've had on your program. We partnered with them to pull together a convening of the new tools that we thought were most exciting for progressive advocacy and progressive electoral work. And building off of that convening in February of 2018, we've partnered with a lot of those tools to sort of see what we could do. So in the midterm elections, the Stand Up America community was a very loud voice in getting out the vote and helping a number of progressive candidates. And to do that, we used a number of these new tools. So a couple that I'm really excited about, one is Mobilize America, which I know you're familiar with, which is a volunteer shifting tool that did not exist before Donald Trump and has really been a game changer in how we were able to plug in our 2 million plus progressives across the country into the progressive races closest to them. So we leaned on that to get tens of thousands of volunteer shifts, which was awesome. The other tool, which has been around a little bit longer, is Hustle that we've used, which is a peer-to-peer texting platform. And our community has now made almost a million peer-to-peer texts in our advocacy and electoral work. We were over 600,000 text messages to help get out the vote. And that's been really effective. We have thousands of people who've raised their hands to be part of our texting team. And people really enjoy the volunteer experience of being able to reach out to their fellow progressives from home. And then other tools, we really focused on SMS. And when I last talked to you, that was beginning to be the case. So we have hundreds of thousands of progressives who are part of our SMS community who get our action alerts. And that has now led to over 400,000 phone calls to Congress from the Stand Up America community. We just passed 400,000 calls on Friday. So we're really excited about that and proud of that. And these new tools have made that work possible.
That's cool. What has surprised you the most in this time since we talked?
Well, Donald Trump continues to surprise me on a daily basis. You never know what you're going to wake up to. You know, I think one thing that has surprised me is the energy around the Trump-Russia investigation. We early on at Stand Up America, you know, stepped back and said, we're a large resistance community, but we also know there are great groups like Indivisible and Swing Left and Move On and others. So where can we provide a unique contribution? Where are there gaps in the work where we can help? And we decided early on that the Trump-Russia investigation was a really important issue that the progressive community, we had no existing infrastructure of how to deal with this attack on our democracy and the need for an investigation. So one thing that's been surprising is the level of enthusiasm and focus and engagement around that issue that we've seen in the last year and a half has really exploded. We went from, you know, really having to do basic in education about the attack on our democracy to demanding the special counsel be appointed, which was incredible when that happened. And then now, as Mueller has made a lot of progress, almost 200 criminal counts now, we've seen the energy in our community around protecting that investigation just grow and grow. So if you had told me we would have had over 150,000 phone calls on the bills to protect Mueller's investigation, if you'd said that to me when we talked a year and a half ago, I would have thought that would be wishful thinking. But Americans and progressives understand how serious this investigation is and how important it is to holding Trump accountable. So that's definitely been one surprise. And so we've doubled down on that work. We do a weekly Trump Russia roundup, which folks can sign up for on our website, where we help people understand the rapid changes in the investigation. And we do quite a bit of advocacy around protecting Mueller and making sure we can get to the truth.
I wonder if you spend any time looking at the other side. So sometimes when you're working hard at mobilizing a progressive group, you don't have time to pay attention to how the other side is mobilizing or what tools they're using. Do you have any chance to look at that?
Yeah, we do some. Honestly, I don't spend a lot of time doing that, but we certainly keep an eye on it. And we talk to folks like Higher Ground Labs who are, you know, working on building these companies and these tools every day. You know, as we talked about a year and a half ago, I think the use of social media, obviously conservatives and the Russians have used it to do a lot of harm. So that we've all been tracking and following. And I think at Stand Up America, we have tried to wrap our head around how can we use effective organizing tactics on social media, but not stoop to the level that they've stooped to. So we don't believe in fake news. We only believe in spreading the truth. And I think there's a way to thread the needle where we can fight back against their tactics, but not put aside our values at the same time. And I, from what I hear, I think they're also starting to see what the progressive movement is doing and copy some of the tactics that are working on our side, things like peer-to-peer texting, where I know progressives did a lot more in the midterms than conservatives had. But, you know, it's an important question, and it's something we all need to keep an eye on.
What has been the biggest challenge for you?
I'd say planning is a big challenge.
Always.
To be a good organizer, you want to be organized, right? And so our team really strives to do that on a day-to-day basis. But then there are the curveballs, right? So there was the period right before the midterms, which was incredibly hard to predict and exhausting for everyone and for the country, where we went right from the Kavanaugh fight, where our community was extremely fired up about fighting back against Kavanaugh's nomination. We drove over 50,000 phone calls and were very loud in that fight. Obviously, that was an emotional roller coaster and incredibly disappointing and devastating that he was confirmed. And then we had no time between the Kavanaugh fight and having to shift into organizing around the midterms and getting out the vote. And then literally the day after a very successful election, Jeff Sessions was forced out. And the national protests, the Trump is not above the law protests that we've been a big partner of, had to be launched the day after the election. So then they happened the following day. So there are periods like that where I worry about burnout for all of us, for our team, for our community, for myself, frankly. But we've been able to push through and persevere. And I never would have guessed that we would have had less than 24 hours after polls closed that we would have to have a national protest to help protect Mueller. So yeah, planning is very difficult. The one thing that's been less difficult, honestly, that a year and a half ago I would have been more worried about when we last spoke, is sustaining the energy of the resistance. You know, if you look back, it's depressing and kind of hard to believe we're at 2 years of Donald Trump now. And I wasn't sure that from the first women's march to today that we'd be able to sustain the energy, sustain the activism and the growth. But that really has happened. And I think what I was just speaking about, the fact that the national protests 2 days after the election to protect Mueller, the fact that progressives who'd worked so hard in the midterms still showed up in droves, I think just speaks to the kind of limitless energy there is to protect our democracy and to resist Trump. And I'm so grateful for that. And I'm just inspired by the fact that it's not just professional organizers who are not letting up. It's the everyday Americans and voters and moms and grandmothers who make the resistance, who just keep going.
You mentioned the Women's March, and there's another installation of that coming up on the 19th. Are groups like yours pushing that this year? Do you think we can make that into a big thing, or how is that looking?
Yeah, we've been part of a lot of national marches in the past, things like the Tax March and the March for Our Lives and the March for Truth. We've decided in 2019 to try to focus a bit more. So we are not one of the organizing partners of the Women's March, but that has a lot to do with bandwidth. And I know the marches are moving forward, but we are, you know, just this month, we are really focused on issues like HR1, like our advocacy in New York, like demanding Donald Trump's tax returns as soon as possible. We just have a lot on our plate. So we're letting other partners lead the charge on that.
I'm curious what your plans are with respect to the 2020 Democratic presidential primary. In the past, substantial groups like yours, like Move On, have, you know, held votes among their membership and made endorsements. Do you plan to get involved, and in what way?
So Stand Up America has been a little unique in that front, in that we have not we've not made endorsements in primaries and have not endorsed one progressive over another or one Democrat over another. So we've really focused on the advocacy for the most part. You know, we are a 501c4 advocacy nonprofit. So our electoral work is a minority of what we do. Certainly, we're going to engage our community in 2020 to help organize and help get rid of Donald Trump. But I think in terms of the primaries, we're going to let those play out. Personally, I think it's exciting to see a lot of candidates stepping forward. I think for the good of our country and for the good of defeating Donald Trump and his agenda, we should have a really robust primary. And I don't think any of us could say today who's going to come out on top. So I think while the primaries unfold at Stand Up America, we're really going to focus on defending the Trump-Russia investigation, holding Trump accountable, demanding his tax returns, protecting our democracy, standing up to his corruption. That important work has to happen at the same time as the Democratic primaries.
I'm curious about how you personally are doing. You referenced, worrying about burnout a little bit. What keeps you in the game? How long do you think you might keep swinging at this? And how are you doing?
Yeah, well, thank you for asking. A lot has changed in my life in the year and a half since we last talked, and it's not just Stand Up America. So my husband, Chris, and I had our first child, our son, David, a year ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So our son is about to turn 13 months. So that is life-changing for anyone. Yeah. To grow our family at the same time as being part of the resistance, it is a lot. And it might sound a little corny, but honestly, having a child in this period is both exhausting, obviously, when there's a young baby at home, but it also keeps me going. And worrying about the future of our country becomes really quite real when you go home and look into your child's eyes and think, how am I going to describe this period of history to him? And how am I going to make sure that our country recovers from this and that he has a climate and a globe that he can inherit, and that the rule of law and the basic core values of our democracy are still around. And, you know, as a parent, I'm still very worried that none of that is inevitable. And so I'm fighting for our community. I'm fighting for our team at Stand Up America, but probably more than anything, I'm fighting for my son.
And your husband is a fairly well-known person. What's he up to right now? What are his projects?
Yeah. So my husband also runs a nonprofit. It's called the Economic Security Project, which he's the co-chair of. And they do, he can speak much more eloquently about the work than I can, but he, they really work on the economic policies that are going to make the biggest difference in the lives of working families. So he's very passionate about things like expanding the EITC and modernizing it to make sure that Americans who are working but still live in poverty have more money in their pockets. And they've been doing some innovative organizing leading up to the 2020 elections to make sure that the most creative and robust economic ideas are in the mix in the presidential race and other races, as well as in state work. So he's quite busy. It's a lot for us both to work in politics at once, but what's nice is he's working on some of the kind of midterm and longer term fights that will reshape our economy, whereas we're often working on the hour to hour, day to day, week to week fights. And that's a nice balance because we're not both working on the exact same issues. And I get to feel invested in some of those longer term fights through him. And I hope he gets to feel invested in those shorter term fights through me.
What else should I have asked you about Stand Up America that I didn't? What else would you like to say?
Yeah, I mean, it's been quite a ride in the last year and a half. You know, when I talked to you, this was really an experiment, a Facebook page. And I didn't have a strong intention to start a particular kind of organization. And it has just really grown into these over 2 million Americans who care, who are engaged, and who want to defend the Trump-Russia investigation, stand up to corruption, strengthen our democracy. So, you know, it's been a ride. I think the most important thing is we need more people to get involved. And, you know, obviously people can check out our website, standupamerica.com. Folks can text the word stand to 21333 to join our SMS program and get our action alerts. I think the other thing I would just say is, you know, all of our work is also possible because of the great partners we have. And I know we talked a little bit about the tools that we use in the midterm elections, but in both our advocacy and our electoral work, the partnerships we've had with other resistance organizations have been critical. With Swing Left, we were part of the last weekend volunteer program, which was just a really smart way of getting people to commit to volunteering. And we partnered with them and got tens of thousands of folks to commit. And they really kicked off that project, and we were able to become a leading collaborator with them. And then even in our Russia work, we've been one of the loudest grassroots communities in the country, but we've also worked very closely with groups like Move on the national protests and on content in a number of different ways that we're advocating to protect Mueller. So I think that the spirit of collaboration that definitely was there in January of 2017, I think it's still there in 2019. And that's inspiring to see, because that doesn't always happen in movements. That doesn't always happen in the progressive landscape. And I think that's endured.
Do you ever have an ability or intention to compare lists with these other big groups and see what overlap there is? And maybe, I mean, do you have a sense of like, are there substantial differences between the millions of people that are in your group versus those others that you've mentioned and some of the longstanding progressive organizations?
Yeah, it's a great question. There have definitely been some conversations around that. It's an analytics question that's a little bit above my pay grade, but from what we can tell, there are definitely some differences in the lists. I think we've attracted you know, folks who really are focused on corruption, on the Trump-Russia investigation in particular, and obviously some other organizations are focused on other issues. There are discussions about how we can dig deeper on that and take a look. But I don't have all the answers, unfortunately.
Well, I really appreciate what you've been up to and hope you keep going. Where would you like this organization to be in another 2 years?
I think we've really found our rallying cry around corruption. And obviously, we're living with the most corrupt White House that we've ever seen in our country. So there are some very urgent fights on that front. But obviously, there is corruption in other parts of our country and our government. And there's a corrupt system, right? We have to not only get rid of Donald Trump and his agenda, we also have to think about how to strengthen our democracy across the board. And I think we are very committed at Stand Up America to being part of that, to expanding voter rights and participation, and to changing our campaign finance system, because we have a corrupt system now where, unfortunately, with the Supreme Court that we have today, there's going to continue to be unlimited corporate money in our elections. And given that, we want to be part of the solutions that can let candidates run without being dependent on that corporate influence. So things like we're doing in New York around fighting for campaign finance reform with a small donor matching program that's going to change the way folks run for office, and it's going to change who can run for office. I think those kind of long-term fights are what we're going to be involved with at Stand Up America, and continuing as well to fight against Donald Trump and his agenda. But we're not going anywhere. I think we have a lot of work to do across the board, and standing up to corruption and strengthening our democracy, I think, is really in our wheelhouse.
That was Sean with Stand Up America, now Ethan with Swing Left. I wanted to catch up with you again about how things went with Swing Left through the election and how things are going now as we prepare for 2020.
Yeah, no, it was a crazy time. It was in retrospect a very heady time, and a crazy cycle. And you know, now that minds are starting to shift to the presidential election in 2020, it's probably good to revisit some of that stuff from 2018, lest we sort of like forget how special it was.
What was the growth like of Swing Left? It seems to me like it became one of the real stars of the new organizations that sprung up in the wake of Trump's election.
Well, thanks. I mean, we had very strong growth early on. And then I think a lot of folks would tell you that energy started to peter out after John Ossoff lost in the spring of 2019. All along,
2017, yeah.
Sorry, 2017. All along, we had anticipated a U-shaped curve of engagement. I think the thing that surprised us was that the bottom of the U was not as far down as we thought, and where the U swung back to in the fall of 2018 was even larger than we had expected.
From the perspective of you as an organization, what were some of the highlights?
So Swing Left was started by myself and a bunch of friends, all of who came from outside of politics. And what we did was we built the thing that we wanted, right? The way that we kind of wanted to engage in politics. And fortuitously, that was at the moment when a lot of other people just like us were getting engaged with politics for the first time. And were prime to engage, but they were looking for something, I think, a little different, right? They weren't looking for a website or an organization that sort of like forced you to, go down a rabbit hole to figure out what they do, or how things work, or how they get engaged. We're talking about a group of people who care about politics, like myself, but who'd never sort of like actively engaged before, and who are used to a world where everything is fairly easy, right? From getting a cab ride to ordering a meal or things like that. And so what we built with Swing Left was a way to engage with political activism that's as easy as ordering dinner on Seamless Web or getting a car from Uber or Lyft, I should say.
So what were the sort of things that people could then do with your application?
Well, I mean, it's fairly simple. We pointed people to the actions that mattered most in the places that matter most, right? Which mainly meant donating and talking to voters, right? In swing congressional districts. And the very cool thing was that about 80% of the country had a swing congressional district, a swing district within about 50 miles of them, right? So everybody had one nearby. So initially there was this like interest, like, what's my closest swing district? What's the one I should focus on? And then, more towards the end, some folks took more of a national focus, like what are the races that need the money the most? Or, maybe my closest one doesn't need as much help. And You know, what's the place that I should really focus? What we wound up doing for people was serving as like a major filter, right? As soon as you say, okay, my district is deep blue, but I want to make a difference. What should I do? You kind of open yourself up to everything, right? There's a billion races you could engage in and a billion different ways that you could engage. And what we did was filter all that down for people. It's like, this is the race you should engage in. And these are the two things you can do because they matter the most.
Could you give a sense of the scale at which that happened?
As far as we can tell, and this is, you know, almost certainly an underestimation on a lot of sides. Our volunteers knocked around 5 million doors, made 2.5 million phone calls, and donated $10 million to Democratic congressional candidates. But anecdotally, we know that, for instance, there were, you know, swing left groups that, you know, raised $1 million for candidates. None of that we had any tracking for. Or, you know, in places that we estimated, say, 40 or 50,000 phone calls were made, groups came back and said, no, we made 250,000 phone calls. We know, we counted. So with that caveat, what we could track, what we had a sense of, what we had an estimate for, was still fairly significant. But I expect that the actual work of our volunteers was much larger than that.
Were you able to raise money for yourself as an organization and grow the staffing there?
Yeah, no. I mean, a lot of money came in to support our sort of get out the volunteers infrastructure, as we called it, because, you know, we didn't actually actively get out. You know what I mean? Like, we weren't paying staffers to go knock doors. Instead, we were building the infrastructure that allowed the volunteers to go knock doors where it mattered the most. We had these Google, YouTube, Facebook engineers come in and help us out and build this, like, called it, like, internally we called it like Tinder for democracy, like swiping options, like, here's the thing you should do. You don't want that? You know, swipe for another one kind of thing. That had a lot of calculations going on in the back end, like how far you were from the district, how important the district was, how the priority of the campaign had placed on the event, etc. But from the user experience, it was really simple. The more we could distill it down for people, the better. 80% of people just took our first recommendation because they were ready to do something and they trusted us to send them to the right place.
What impact do you think you had, therefore?
On a number of races, particularly ones close to deep blue areas, I think we had a really significant impact in terms of the voter contact. For a number of races, we were supplying up to 50% of the volunteers or more. We had made people aware of those races nearby, and we were making it really easy for them to plug in. A lot of these races that were really close, a lot of the races overall were really close. And so those are the sorts of races where, you know, things like knocking doors and every dollar that gets donated makes a significant difference. You saw districts like Staten Island flip. Nobody was expecting that. Well, guess what? You know, we sent like all of Brooklyn out there. They were like able to canvass the state of, the island of Staten Island, all the houses they wanted to hit in a single day, right? And then they were able to do it again the next day and the next day. And you see that reflected in, like, you know, no one was expecting New York 11 to flip. So, and there was a lot of races like that. You know, the fact that we flipped all the SoCal districts, there was an amazing turnout of volunteers in that area. California 10, California 21, those were San Francisco's main projects. The thing is, we turned out a massive wave of volunteers on that last weekend, but we also, for a lot of these areas, were setting people in almost 2 years in advance, both building the infrastructure, getting the experience, and talking and building relationships with those voters to allow that wave to crest at the right time. I think the impact of our volunteers and donors was significant.
That's got to feel pretty heady for you and your team.
I mean, yeah, for like 5 minutes. and then you realize that, like, Trump is still president, and all we can do is say no, and we can't sort of like set any policy. And, you know, that those crazy conspiracy theories that you have that Donald Trump is a Russian asset, like, may not be crazy enough. And you realize there's just so much more work to do.
There is. Can you just say, like, how did you fit yourself into the progressive ecosystem? along with other groups? Who did you partner with, and what other innovations going on there were helpful in getting done what you needed to get done?
Well, we partnered with everybody. I mean, we built this last weekend coalition that like signed on like every progressive group you can think of. And the goal there was to sort of like speak with a single voice. We've all got different sort of specifics on what we're asking you to do and who you're asking to do it for. But we all want you out there talking to voters in the last weekend. And that seemed to be a really successful campaign. People really sort of glommed onto it. And I think we've been successful in that we sort of see ourselves as a partner for, you know, organizations big and small, whether or not it's, you know, Indivisible Orange County or Swing Left Greater Boston, or, you know, a national organization like, you know, Planned Parenthood or something. We are an organization that focuses on elections year round while other people kind of go back and forth. And so one of our goals is, you know, to build infrastructure and tools that people are going to want to plug into at every level, from an individual to a local group to a national group. Like, you guys go work on, you know, pressuring members of Congress and advocating for really good policies. And we're going to be here, you know, doing the hard work of elections all the time and getting things ready for when the campaign season comes around.
What you're talking about has traditionally been the role of a political party. How do you view the Democratic Party in that respect? Because they are also hard at work.
Yeah, I mean, we partnered quite a bit with the Democratic Party. We work with the DCCC. You know, we work with the DNC. I would say that the Democratic Party needs to sort of serve a lot of different constituents in its process. And what we are is, you know, a grassroots focused electoral organization, right? We have a bias towards stuff that people can do. And so our job is to engage people, the grassroots activists, in elections year round, which I don't think is the sort of traditional focus of the Democratic Party. You know, people like me who feel like, you know, the way we're really going to make gains is by knocking these bozos out of office, and that's what we should focus on. There's a lot of people who kind of share that perspective, but a lot of them, you know, would traditionally say, well, what can I do until there's actually a campaign? And so we've worked hard to sort of, you know, build tools and actions that people can be effective with, you know, year-round, even when you don't know who you're going to be supporting. You know, these elections are so important that, you know, we can't wait until the summer of 2020 to get to work. Same thing with the midterms of 2018. We launched with that premise that the midterms of 2018 were going to be the most important election ever. And it was too important to wait. So we got to get to work now. And that's what we did.
And obviously, one of the secrets to your success was a pretty laser-like focus on a subset of congressional races. Are you going to maintain that focus, or are you going to broaden out as you attack the 2020 cycle?
Well, we're broadening out to focus on a number of different races, but I agree that focus in terms of the races that you choose to support is incredibly important. We're just not saying it's only going to be House races anymore, because we were in a cycle last time around where you could credibly say, you know, it's all about the House and we have to focus all of our energy there because we can put it both for need. We need to put a check on Donald Trump, and the House was the best way to do it. Right. Obviously, we wanted to try to make gains or really, you know, slow the number of losses in the Senate. But that's always what it was going to be. So with the House, we had this sort of unique situation where that clearly was the thing to focus on, in addition to, you know, in certain states, governor races, et cetera. Or at least we could make an argument for that. And now, if you choose to only focus on one thing, say the Senate or the presidency or state houses for redistricting kind of thing, you're really leaving out an important priority in the cold.
So what are you going to do different?
Again, we sort of see ourselves as a user-focused, a volunteer-focused, a donor-focused organization, right? You are an average person. You are upset with the course of our country and you want to do something. You want to do something tangible that will make a difference. We are there to put you to work, to make sure your donation gets directed in the best way possible, to make sure, you know, the volunteer work, the time you're willing to put in has the greatest impact possible in terms of the effect it's going to have now on the 2020 election. Practically, we're going to defend the House. More of that will be done in 2020 once we know how vulnerable, you know, who the vulnerable House members are really going to be. And then there's a lot of offense work that needs to be done, as I mentioned before, to try to take back the Senate. We definitely have that opportunity this cycle where it was not super realistic last cycle. Obviously, taking back the White House is, you know, the number one priority for everybody, although that's a very, very large task. We all have to focus on that. And then, you know, I think the other big thing really going on in 2020 is that we have a chance to reverse some of the major and insidious losses that we suffered in 2010, which allowed, you know, in the state house, which allowed the Republicans to take these states that were these 50-50 states, like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and North Carolina, and like wildly gerrymander them in their favor. And they were able to do that in the 2011 redistricting. And now we have the 2021 redistricting coming up. And we have, you know, all this energy and we have the opportunity to, you know, to take back some of those state houses and redraw some of those lines, redraw fair maps that are actually representative of the peoples of those states. And oh, by the way, make it a hell of a lot easier to hold on to the House. I like to say that everything we did over the last 2 years helped, you know, give us control of the House for 2 years. But what we can do over the next 2 years can, you know, help ensure control of the House for 10 years or more.
So does that mean that you will now overlap in the missions of Flippable and Sister District and the DLCC and other people that are working on the state legislative races, the, you know, our the redistricting entities and so on? Or how will there be combination, or how are you going to work with them?
Yeah, I mean, in the same way we overlapped with the DCCC in terms of what we were doing before, right? You know, we have great relationships with all those organizations and, you know, the folks like the DLCC we're getting to know, we didn't sort of know previously. But again, from the perspective of a volunteer or a donor who wants to engage, you don't want to say, well, we're only doing this. You're saying, okay, you want to make a difference. These are all the things that really make a difference. And, you know, we're going to help you do that.
Will you provide an opportunity through your tools for people to get involved in the Democratic presidential primary process?
No, we don't take sides in primaries. And I mean, I believe in primaries. I think they're a good way to sort of make sure you get the best candidates. I think we saw that a lot of the competitive primaries in the 2018 cycle delivered us some amazing candidates as part of the process. So like, I'm all for the primary process. You know, I don't think anyone really knows who the best or most electable candidates. I mean, like if you have a particular candidate, you're passionate about some candidate or some issue, by all means, you should, you know, get involved there. But if you just want to work on getting ready to beat Donald Trump, you shouldn't necessarily be spending your money in a primary.
Can you just talk a little bit about Swing Left as an organization? How do you guys make decisions? And, you know, how do you call the shots?
We're kind of in the process of restructuring the organization, because I think we sort of built it a little bit more like a campaign last cycle, and now we kind of want to refigure it more as an organization, this grassroots funnel into electoral work for the long term. And you know, we kind of grew pretty quickly, especially at the end of the last cycle, to be able to handle that sort of like massive GOTV flood, and you know, a lot of those people were kind of around just for that cycle. So, you know, we have a leadership team that, you know, we're actually in the process of hiring a bunch of awesome roles, you know, heads of various departments. We have a very collaborative process. You know, ideas kind of come from anywhere. Then we sort of like tend to put them into, you know, a little more fleshed out form to share with the wider team. You know, we'd like to sort of like build a consensus around some of the major initiatives. Like, is this the right direction to go? We tend to do a very sort of like iterative a process and those kinds of things because, you know, ideas are never sort of perfect when they're sort of first formed, and we sort of let them go through the process. And they almost always get to the point where everybody's sort of like on board with, you know, the name, the idea, et cetera, and we're all psyched and ready to go out there and implement it.
What have you learned about sort of building a political enterprise that you can share with other people that might be trying to do it?
Just because people have done it a certain way for a long time, or just because no one's ever done it, doesn't mean that it's the wrong thing to do. In fact, very often it's the right thing to do. You know what I mean? I found that probably one of the best things that I've brought personally of coming from outside of politics is just like a questioning approach. Well, why do we do it that way? Well, okay. I mean, because you don't necessarily look at the underlying reasons why a thing has been done a certain way. And often it's that reason is, you know, 5, 10, 20, 30, 40 years old. And no longer is the grounds for anything anymore. Like, a great example is what we did with our sort of district funds, where were these funds that held money in escrow for the eventual nominees of our swing districts. When we came up with that idea, you know, more established folks said, is that really going to work? Are people going to donate to a candidate they've never heard of, or rather whose name they don't even know, a faceless candidate? And we said, well, let's try it. And it turns out that it was incredibly effective because people just wanted to win. They just wanted to sort of like, you know, beat Trump and the GOP. And this was the most effective way of doing it. But, you know, the conventional wisdom was that, you know, people want to donate to a candidate, not against someone. Right. But in this moment that we're living in of just, you know, high partisanship, but not just high partisanship of where one party is basically in, you know, hostage to, you know, depending on your interpretation, either a, you know, a Russian asset or a sort of like, you know, your grandpa who watches Fox News kind of thing. People just want to win. They just want to sort of like fight back against that overarching problem. And so the old rules didn't necessarily apply, and we were able to be really successful at that function. So I think, you know, the ability to sort of like really question the premises of why things are done a certain way, and whether or not that's really now the most effective way to do things, is really valuable, because all the things that you know, the average public out there is looking to engage, you know, doesn't know those things, right? They don't start from that place. So fresh eyes, you know, can be invaluable.
How are you feeling in terms of making this a big part of your life going off into the future? This was, as you put it, a new area for you. Are you going to keep going with it? Is it maintaining its excitement for you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited by the idea of getting Trump out of office. I'm excited by the idea of, you know, taking the Senate and holding the House and, you know, getting fair maps in the 2021 redistricting. And I'm excited about the idea of like trying to build a way for people to connect with elections in the long term, because that was never there. And it maybe if it had been, I would have been more sort of politically engaged beforehand. And so the hope is really to turn this into something self-sustaining, where it's going to always be there for people who want to make a difference in elections. Because I think that the great strength of the left and the Democratic Party, however you want to call it, is, you know, we have greater numbers of people, and we have amazing people who are capable of amazing things, but you need to give them a way to, you know, take their time, their talents, their money, whatever it is, and put it towards the ends of winning these elections. And if you do that, I think we can sort of like build a sustaining force that can actually push our country back on the course that we thought it was on, you know, when Obama was president.
Anything else I should have asked you that I failed to that would help illustrate where you are or where you're going?
one really interesting challenge has been sort of doing this as an all virtual organization, as some orgs are, you know, MoveOn famously is, it'll let you get sort of representation from across the country, and people sort of like hearing their own, you know, overlapping but different echo chambers. I think that's also been key to our success, is just sort of not, you know, to be a national organization, not being in DC, being in all the places where people like us live who want to engage in these things, Chicago, New York. I live in Western Massachusetts, San Francisco, LA, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's been really cool as well.
Those interviews were with Sean and Ethan with Stand Up America and Swing Left. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.